Hi, welcome to another podcast by the Oxford Society for International Development. We're glad to have you here. My name is Yulun, and in this episode, we're going to talk about the economics of happiness in Asia. We're going to take a look at the quite perplexing case of the happiness gap in Asia, where despite the dramatic growth in GDP, some countries have not really been experiencing an increase in happiness, and in some cases, it has come at the cost of happiness. This certainly prompts the question of whether we have put the cart before the horse and whether we should look for other ways to accurately measure development and what is meant by it. So this will lead us to the very interesting case of Bhutan, this little mountainous country in Asia where its government has prioritized happiness as its developmental model. We're going to consider its successes, some of its challenges, and we're going to talk to two very interesting people who are the experts in this field. We hope you enjoy. Growing up in rural China, I was very much surprised by the economic development that was happening all around me. Even after I moved to Europe, every time that I went back, I'll just be surprised and truly fascinated by the amount of change and development that has happened in the country. Now, given this very impressive economic development, you would suspect that people are, in general, becoming happier. And to a certain extent, this is true. Material possessions are inevitably things that improve your quality of life. But to a large extent, this also overlooks a big part of the problem. If you were to look at, you know, the youth in Asia, for example, and you see how there is a prevalent rise in anxiety and depression and in suicide, you can tell that there are some things that are being overlooked. There is a feeling of loneliness and of discontent with how things are. And I think mere material pursuits is really unable to provide the feeling of belonging that so many people look for. And you can also turn to the environment and see how people's hometowns, including to a great extent mine, are being overturned by, you know, big housing projects, which bring you wealth, but it inevitably also takes away a big part of our attachment to the natural environment around us. And something that is especially problematic, I think, within my country, China, is the very troublesome trade-off that some people have to make between their cultural identity and material well-being. You know, for a lot of the minority in China, it is a very real choice between teaching your kids your cultural mother tongue or sending them to school and allowing them to learn Mandarin. And because there really isn't the free time to teach them both. And sometimes you will have to prioritize the latter because it gives them a better choice of universities and a better chance of securing a job. This also goes beyond the minority, and it's prevalent within society. For a lot of people, they have to make the choice between working an extra hour and earning money and perhaps securing rent for the month or celebrating cultural festivities. And that is a very tough choice to make, which evidently is not a happy choice to make as well. I think the very apparent problem that is the root of all these three cases is that GDP does not really measure what we mean by development. It certainly overlooks some social, cultural, and environmental things which we consider very dear to our understanding of a good life. And this is actually very problematic because if we perceive GDP as a measure of development, then we're going to have our politicians implement our policies and judge them according to GDP. And they're going to effectively design policies with a lot of gaping holes in them, which are inevitably very unbalanced in the things that they're going to improve. I mean, just as an example, you could have a country that is experiencing, say, 8% GDP growth and see itself as doing very well without recognizing all the damages that it's doing on its society, on its culture, and on its environment, which are not captured by GDP. So it's inevitably think that it's developing when for its people, it might be a very tough ride to material prosperity. So I definitely think it's important that we reevaluate the ways that we measure development. And I think a very good way to start on this critical reassessment of our developmental models is to understand the current limitations of GDP.
Measures like GDP or GNI are, I think they're regularly held up as proxies for a country's development. So economic growth is really equated with development. But, one doesn't really have to think too deeply to see that there are some problems with this. And I'll give you just a couple of them. I think most obviously there are, negative kinds of activities that can contribute to GDP and therefore economic growth. But we wouldn't really consider such negative activities as development, right? So a really simple example, let's say a car crash that sends someone to the hospital. That contributes money to the economy through, getting a tow truck, the hospital costs, needing to buy a new car, so all that contributes wealth to the economy. Yet we would hardly call, someone being severely injured in a car crash as something to pursue in the name of development. Or similar, let's say, a strip mine that generates wealth but does so by destroying the environment, paying low wages, maybe displaces indigenous peoples. That isn't what we would consider development. So that's kind of the first problem. A second problem is that, measures of economic growth like GDP really say nothing about the distribution of that growth. So you might have two economies with, similar measures of GDP per capita, but one has growth that's, concentrated, let's say, within the top 1 or 2%, while another has it more equitably distributed. So simply looking at GDP per capita really tells you nothing about this difference in distribution. So, I think current measures of economic development really are only, they're partial measures of development that provide a partial picture only. But of course, development is or should be a much broader concept that incorporates, multiple social, political, ecological, and cultural aspects.
That was the voice of Dr. Kent Schroeder. He has over 20 years of experience working on sustainable development initiatives in Asia, Africa, the Caribbean, and around the world. In my opinion, what makes Kent's insight especially valuable is that he is the executive director of the Bhutan Canada Foundation and himself has worked very closely in a number of initiatives in Bhutan since 2006. The thing that makes Bhutan an especially remarkable country is that it has focused on gross national happiness as its model of development. Now, rather than me going into the details of how gross national happiness is measured and what it stands for, I think Kent is in a much better position to talk about it.
So, gross national happiness, or GNH, is it's an alternative development model that moves beyond an all-consuming focus on economic growth as the primary, the only measure of development. So it's really a holistic and integrated model of development that articulates or conceptualizes an understanding of development that incorporates multiple interrelated social, economic, cultural, ecological, and governance dimensions. So it's really a holistic, integrated approach that moves beyond sort of that sole focus on economic growth. And interestingly, it was initially conceptualized as four pillars. And these pillars were equitable socioeconomic development, environmental sustainability, cultural preservation and promotion, and good governance. And pursuing development, involves promoting those four pillars and understanding them as integrated, so they're interrelated with one another. And I think the important thing to note, and I think is often misunderstood, is that in promoting those four pillars, you're not, the Bhutanese aren't creating happiness through the promotion of those four pillars. But what GNH does is it puts in place the enabling conditions for people to be happy through those four pillars. So, creating a society where there is, equitable access to education and to good healthcare, where there is meaningful employment, where there is a sort of a flourishing environment and culture, and where you have a government that is, transparent and effective and efficient. Those are the things that create the enabling conditions for individual and collective happiness. Now, those four pillars of GNH were more recently revised into nine domains, and those domains sort of further expand and break out those four pillars into those nine domains. And in terms of measurement, it's quite interesting. These nine domains are measured through a series of 33 indicators, and those indicators are constructed from, I think it's, I don't know, 120 or more variables. And so data is collected on those nine domains, and those domains are weighted equally, and their results are aggregated into sort of a single measure of national GNH in Bhutan. And I think what's very interesting is the Bhutanese, every 5 years or so, they carry out a national GNH survey, and they collect this GNH data around the nine domains. And that data can then be used to, evaluate existing policies and also formulate new ones. So a very interesting application of this philosophical approach to a measurement tool to actually measure gross national happiness in Bhutan.
So then in Bhutan, what's the relationship between GDP and GNH. Has GNH effectively replaced GDP, or are these material indicators still relevant in the sense that they act as complements to each other?
That's actually a great question, because there's often a misperception that Bhutan has replaced GDP with GNH, but that it really hasn't. GDP still plays an important role in measuring economic growth in Bhutan. And GDP doesn't, or GNH, sorry, doesn't discount the importance of GDP and economic growth, but it's not sort of viewed as an end in itself from a GNH perspective. So again, economic growth is interconnected with those social, ecological, cultural, and governance concerns. So just to give an example, if economic growth is interrelated with ecological and social concerns, that growth, you know, it's important for generating meaningful employment and to access universal healthcare. But at the same time, that growth shouldn't promote, you know, overconsumption that degrades natural resources. So really the notion of balance is critical. And you'll often hear the word balance when people talk about GNH. It's not economic growth as an end in itself or at all costs. It's a means to something more. So GNH really doesn't replace GDP. It locates it within a more appropriate understanding of development as sort of this holistic process.
So I think it goes without saying that GNH as a policy will be very tough to implement, mainly because of how many changes and tweaks will be necessary to make sure that it fulfills its intended purpose. On this end, could you tell us a bit more about the right characteristics that a government should have to make sure that it implements GNH adequately to its cultural and social context?
You know, one of the things I like about the way the Bhutanese have approached GNH is that, they're open to its evolution and to its ongoing development. And, you know, hopefully through improvement or through that evolution, there is some kind of improvement. So, you know, for example, you have, you know, GNH was initially sort of seen as a philosophical approach, and then it became a practical model with a measurement index and policy tools. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the original four pillars evolved into an expansion into nine domains that sort of better capture the holistic nature of GNH.
Now, from my own perspective, I definitely feel like GNH has made a very good case for itself. But I think for a lot of people, you know, who have a more realistic experience of how it feels like to live in, you know, a developing area, they might think that, well, if I'm truly poor or deprived of a lot of material necessities, then regardless of how much you focus on happiness or on culture and environment, I'm never really going to be able to shake off the stress and the worry of not being able to find food to feed my family. So in this sense, do you think GNH is something that should be pursued by developing countries only after they reach a certain level of material prosperity? Or is this really just a false dichotomy?
That's a great question. And for me, it's a little bit of a challenging one to answer. There's all kinds of research over the last few decades that explores the relationship between happiness and income. And, you know, I think it's safe to say that the answer is complicated, but yes, there is some connection between happiness and level of individual income. Now, what that level is, and, you know, when there are diminishing returns, I think that remains an ongoing debate. And, there are certainly other people who can speak to that a lot more eloquently than I can. But what I would add, though, is that this debate is largely, it's based on notions of subjective happiness. And that's not the notion of happiness that underlies GNH. Subjective happiness is about one's current emotional state. You know, if you go to a restaurant, you have a good meal and you're happy, you're joyful about it. Or it might be about people's, you know, cognitive appraisal of overall life satisfaction. And that's how we tend to understand happiness in the global north. But happiness in GNH, you know, is understood quite differently. It's sort of this well-rounded balance of the material and the non-material. And GNH happiness is therefore, you know, multidimensional. It recognizes that material needs need to be balanced with cultural, you know, governance, even spiritual needs. And then again, further recognizing that we as humans are inherently interconnected with the environment, and that's connected to our happiness as well. So it's very different than our sort of Western understanding of happiness. And so in that sense, I think that sort of addresses this notion of is happiness and income, is that a dichotomy that's problematic, or should they be separated out? But once you move away from that notion of subjective happiness, I think the multidimensional nature of GNH emphasizes the balance between that material and non-material things. So in a GNH sense, happiness by definition is not attainable only through economic development when it's defined in terms of income and economic growth. It's attainable when the enabling conditions related to equitable socioeconomic development, you know, environmental sustainability, cultural preservation, and good governance are pursued. So there's not really a dichotomy there. It's, again, it's the notion of balance, right? Happiness is achieved when there's a balance of that economic development with these other dimensions.
So this is the day after the interview. I'm doing the voiceovers now, and I just happened to hear again what Kent had to say on this different conception of happiness. And I think it's definitely worth my time to reiterate what he said because of how important it is to our understanding of GNH. And this understanding of happiness as something that is not purely your psychological state of being happy, but as something more concerned about general and long-term human well-being is especially important. So it's definitely wrong to see the happiness in GNH as this hedonistic understanding, where if it was implemented, it would tell you to spend the entirety of your budget on arts and craft and entertainment and none of it on bringing on greater material prosperity. So say if a village was considering to build a new factory, GNH will not say no, but instead it will tell you to consider where to place the factory so as to minimize its damages on the people around them, so as to minimize the damages and the spillovers that it may have on the environment. So it's more important to see GNH as this holistic and pragmatic and calculated approach to development than as this hedonistic pursuit of psychological happiness. And in doing so, you start to realize that GNH is essentially taking an extra step of consideration, which is possible if you're building a simple well or a new high-tech factory. Now, of course, I do not want to give the impression that Bhutan has become this idyllic world after its implementation of the GNH. The truth is, the implementation of GNH itself is it's a patchy process, which requires a lot of change. And in the recent decades, there has been some growing discontent with how GNH is, both within Bhutan itself and outside of it. And some of the main concerns point to its material underperformance, such as its very high youth unemployment, which has persisted throughout the last decade. And these evidently raise a cynical eye as to whether these are the problems inherent with GNH's focus on happiness, or whether these are just issues that every developing country faces. Frankly, I'm in no position to talk on this eloquently, but thankfully, over the weekend, I had the chance to talk to Professor Jeremy Brooks, an environmental social scientist from The Ohio State University that takes on the multidisciplinary approach to understand development. Here's what he had to say about the limitations that Bhutan faces over its implementation of gross national happiness.
2013 was my last visit there, and that actually came, I believe it was just after their second national democratic election. And that, for me, was my first exposure to some of the internal controversy around GNH. I had read some writings of foreign scholars who were critical of this idea that concerns about it being problematic purely from an economic perspective, that, you know, they didn't feel that, you know, given the economic conditions and some of the social and economic challenges that Bhutan was facing, there was a feeling from some sort of Western scholars that GNH was sort of going to be insufficient for, it was a sort of utopian vision that wasn't realistic and was not going to help them overcome the challenges they were facing. But everyone I'd spoken to within Bhutan prior to that, you know, I'd spent a lot of time there in 2005 and 2006, and then again in 2008, when a lot of this was being developed, I remember meeting some of the folks early on, Karma Ora and Nick Marks was contributing to some of this, developing the index back in 2006. For the most part, people were positive about it. In 2013, after the election, was my first exposure to some of the critiques of it internally. And Sharon Toge had just been elected prime minister. And from what I recall, he ran on a platform that was, it was critical of GNH, not so much of the concept. I don't think he was, I don't think he disagreed with the sentiment that having a more holistic view and understanding of development and human progress was important. I think he disagreed with the amount of emphasis that was being placed on it and the amount of emphasis that was being placed on sort of marketing it globally to what he felt, I think, was the detriment of Bhutan's actual sort of progress internally. And I think he felt that it was becoming a bit of a distraction, and it was, you know, preventing Bhutan from addressing some of the significant social and economic problems that it faced.
Could you just expand a little bit on what you mean by, you know, the prime minister thinking there was too much of an emphasis on GNH?
Sure. I think it was, there might have been two parts to it. And again, this is a fuzzy recollection from 2013. And I probably should have gone back and read some of my notes and some of the articles from that time a little more closely. But I think one part was at the time, this was either right before or right after there had been a special sort of UN like session on gross national happiness that was promoted by the previous prime minister, I believe. And there was this effort to sort of put the concept on the global stage. And so one critique was, let the rest of the world worry about how they perceive GNH. It's great to promote it, but we don't need to go overboard in promoting it if it's detrimental to our focus on improving things at home. So I think one aspect of it was just a critique of the effort to sort of market it and wave the flag globally, as opposed to sort of returning emphasis to sort of the nuts and bolts of what was going on at home. And then the other part was, the way I would maybe articulate it is that, you know, there's this, you know, GNH by nature is holistic. It's trying to find a balance between multiple sort of goals. And I think there was a feeling that some of those objectives, the more sort of traditionally economic objectives, were being should receive more prominence at that time. So given the challenges that Bhutan was facing with, you know, youth unemployment and substance abuse and sort of looking ahead at that sort of next generation of Bhutanese, feeling like because of this holistic focus, we're sort of failing our youth right now, and we need to sort of maybe shift emphasis, at least for a little while, back to a more sort of traditional economic productivity development pathway, not necessarily losing sight of the value of GNH overall, but over time, and maybe this is my, I'm inserting this here, this isn't something that necessarily I came across while I was there, but you know, if you think about GNH as a sort of living organism, almost, that at different stages in a life cycle, it may need to emphasize different things. And, you know, maybe at that point in Bhutan's sort of development life cycle, there was a need for an emphasis on growth and a need to de-emphasize other aspects of GNH. I think the challenge, and this is something that was articulated to me by folks in Bhutan that I worked with, was you always have to have this sort of long-term implications or keep the long-term implications of those decisions in mind, because if you de-emphasize other aspects of GNH, whether it's the cultural components or the psychological components or the environmental components, to focus on economic growth in the short term, well, that might erode your capacity to return to those other components in the long term. And I think that's always been the sort of tough balance point for Bhutan, is that, you know, for portions of the Bhutanese, public, is if we do want more emphasis on economic growth at a certain point in time, is there a way to manage that so that it doesn't run out of control and prohibit us from returning to the sort of full GNH sort of package later on? And so I think that was probably some of the tension that was being that emerged through that sort of campaign in 2013 at then that second national election, and some of those problems still exist. I mean, I think youth unemployment has long since I've been there been a problem in Bhutan. I think it's now becoming more well known that the problems with sort of mental health and suicide are more problematic than people had realized for a long time. There still are issues with substance abuse and domestic violence. But, you know, these challenges are not by any means limited to Bhutan, or not unique to Bhutan. So I don't think it's necessarily the case that GNH itself has been a barrier to overcoming these problems. I think the question isn't, has GNH caused Bhutan to sort of stagnate economically? The question is, would another development approach have put Bhutan in a better position than they are now? And I'm not convinced that that's the case necessarily. I think possibly in terms of unemployment, maybe a sort of more strict traditional GDP-centered development approach might have been put them on a better path from an employment perspective or an overall economic activity perspective. But as we know from other parts of the world, that approach, you know, where you solve one problem, you create others. So it's a matter of finding the balance between those sort of trade-offs. And so one thing that I do want to say in terms of these controversies is that as foreigners, and this was something that really hit home to me early on in my time there, when people would ask, well, are Bhutanese always, are all of them really happy? And I'd say, well, you know, they generally are, you know, culturally a happy, warm, fun, you know, group of people. But we as foreigners, it's not fair for folks to put the expectation that Bhutan has solved all these problems because they've developed this this idea, this concept of gross national happiness. I mean, I think it's important for folks viewing Bhutan from outside and even foreigners viewing it from inside to temper our expectations, because I don't think it would be fair to expect that that just because Bhutan is pursuing this unique approach means that they've arrived at the sort of the end goal, right? So I think gross national happiness is an objective and it's a process, but it doesn't mean we should expect that they have hit the end point and are sort of found, you know, the magic, the silver bullet that's going to cure all of our development woes.
Right. I definitely think, yeah, I think that's a very good point, especially because of how easy it is to take the branding of gross national happiness and then set a bar that is a bit too unrealistic. And I think the analogy to a silver bullet is very fitting here. You know, it's constantly a process. So it's not right for you to, you know, pick and see a problem with GNH and say that everything that it espouses for is incorrect. Because at the end of the day, it's a developmental model. And it is, you know, it acknowledges that it needs to be improved. Now, I think apart from that, one worry that it has constantly creeped up in my mind is how the GNH, by almost preserving or attempting to cherish the national identity and the national culture that is present, could be used as means for the government to act paternalistic, where it goes to say, well, for the sake of national identity or for some sort of social stability, it is necessary that, you know, you do not express different values or, you know, don't practice a different way of cultural expression so that we can preserve things that make people happy. Do you think that this is a valid threat?
You know, I think that's a valid critique. I think that's another one of these balance points where maintaining cultural traditions is really important to the identity of the country. And it's important to helping them solve collective challenges that they face. But sort of cultural stasis can be problematic as well. And it can be used to sort of oppress communities if they want to break out of that cultural stasis. So I think it's important for us to keep some of these critiques in mind, even if we support the overall goal and objective. I think there are always ways that these kinds of approaches, these different viewpoints, can, you know, if there are problems that emerge with them that can be addressed, they should be. Yeah.
Okay, so let's now work with a hypothetical. Suppose that you had a magical button, and with the press of a button, you could change the world by implementing GNH in all countries, or perhaps in just your country. If given the chance, would you press the button?
So probably not. And there's two reasons why. One is that GNH is, well, I guess, so I want to make a distinction. So GNH, the philosophy, I think is something that would be great for everyone to adopt. And that if I could push a button, that would be the sort of driving sort of philosophy for most governments. But I want to separate that from the GNH index and the tool that they use to measure their progress on GNH. And I don't think it would be wise to mandate the sort of measurement tools and the specifics of how the philosophy of GNH have been sort of implemented in Bhutan. And I think part of the reason is how the Bhutanese conceptualize GNH and how the Bhutanese conceptualize what's needed for the well-being of their populace is pretty culturally distinct. And it's not something that would or should be adopted in other cultural contexts. I mean, just as sort of very clear examples, they have two of their measures in their GNH index are very specific to their cultural, this perspectives on and capacities with the 13 sort of traditional arts, Zurich Chusum. And so that's not something that sort of translates outside of Bhutan. And perspectives and observance of traditional sort of practices. Drigjam Namlai, I can't remember the term for that. Driglam Namja, I think it is. And these are very specific Bhutanese cultural practices that would not apply outside of Bhutan. And I don't even know if you would necessarily need to or want to find analogs to those practices elsewhere. So I think exporting the philosophy of a more holistic approach to development and a broader concept of what it means to improve well-being, I would love to sort of push a button and have that adopted all over. How that's applied and the form that it takes in any given context, I think should be much more culturally specific.
Now, if we zoom out a little bit and just understand the academic discussion about GNH, one thing that is very surprising is that I think for me, most of the people who are calling for, a revision of the way that we see development or in how we measure development and human happiness has not come from economists, but have really come from philosophers. Right, so people like Michael Sandel and Peter Singer, they are, you know, the people who are essentially chanting for change in the way that we see development and well-being. And one thing that really struck me was how philosophy, I guess in many ways, it's a very interdisciplinary subject where there is a bit of knowledge about everything. And do you think that this kind of hints to a bigger problem about academia where, you know, GNH, or at least the way that we should see development, should in some senses be holistic, yet it's very easy for academics to fall into their own niche and see things from sometimes, you know, quite a unidimensionary perspective, which perhaps is not really equipped to solve the problems that we're facing, which themselves need a very holistic, very broad solution.
Yeah, that was a really big question. And it's a good one because it sort of, this idea of academia being underprepared to tackle these kinds of big picture, complex, interdisciplinary sort of topics. I think before I answer that, it's important for me to give you a sense of how I see myself as an academic, because that's going to shape, you know, how I answer. And I do have a biased opinion on this. So I see myself as being a connector. Right, I don't have a great deal of depth in any one sort of disciplinary area. I technically have a PhD in ecology, but I'm not an ecologist. My advisor was an evolution anthropologist, but I'm not an anthropologist. And I've published in conservation biology journals and ecological economics journals, and journals that tend to be targeted by policy scholars and sociologists. But I don't fit any of those categories either. So, the way I've approached my sort of career and research in academia is to find the spaces between disciplinary perspectives and to find the overlap between disciplinary perspectives and try to work there. And so I really value the connections between disciplines. And so I see that, yes, that academia is underprepared to tackle some of these big questions out there. But I think, thankfully, that is starting to change. And I think, you know, academia is coming out of this like century of siloing, where each discipline had their own culture and own language and own expectations and their own worldviews. And that was really beneficial in some ways for creating that the depth of knowledge that we've really benefited from in each of those areas. But I think that's also a formula for getting only a partial view of the world and limiting the tools that you have available to solve the complex problems that we're facing. So, I mean, I think that that sort of Chinese parable of the four blind men encountering an elephant, you know, for the first time and being asked to describe it, it's pretty apt here, where each discipline has their own view of the most important structures and processes and dynamics that make up the world, but none of them necessarily give you the full picture. So, so I think that has left us sort of scrambling to understand and address some of these interdisciplinary challenges. And, you know, it's, I think academics get comfortable working in areas that I know that they know, and even me, who sees myself as an interdisciplinary scholar and someone who seeks to break out and make connections with other disciplines, you know, it's pretty easy to fall into your sort of niche, and to because it's hard to work with new languages, new jargon, new methods, to get across different ontologies and epistemologies. So it's hard to do that, but I think fortunately academia is in the process of sort of, you know, we've dug really deep disciplinary holes over the past 100+ years. And now we're starting to, in some cases, like tunnel sideways to connect those deep holes or to get ourselves out of those holes to have a bird's eye view, which I think is really important for some of these things that we're facing. So, and I think GNH is a good example of that, right? So it's an example of finding a new objective, a new goal for development, an example of finding new ways to measure and understand what happiness means, what well-being means, or life satisfaction or quality of life. And then going beyond that to figure out what are the factors or conditions that improve all those things. And to do that, you need scholarship from philosophy and psychology and economics and anthropology and sociology. And you also need to connect that then with what we're learning from ecology and environmental science and conservation biology. And I think, yeah, so GNH is a nice sort of example of that kind of, it's a holistic perspective, but it's also a perspective that requires a holistic set of knowledge and tools to understand whether and how it can be sort of effectively employed and what the impacts of it will be.
Now, throughout my interview with Professor Brooks, one thing that kept fascinating me was how he drew from multiple disciplinary perspectives to answer the questions. And I think with regards to questions about development and international development, this is a very necessary step that we should take. Because at the end of the day, development concerns what we mean to live a good life, a better life. And I think our evaluation of that takes on from multiple sources, multiple criteria which we evaluate it against. And many times we often make it a disservice by only thinking of it in terms of material possessions and not in terms of things that may perhaps even be spiritual or environmental, which are equally responsible for our well-being and perhaps make us even feel more sustained happiness throughout our lives. And, you know, zooming out to everything that was said in this interview, I think regardless of whether you think GNH is a right way to look at international development, either from a theoretical or from just, you know, a practical perspective, I think it is still necessary for us to contemplate whether our measures of development really capture what we mean by development, right? Because I think a prevalent sense among, I guess, the student body around the university is that sometimes just having mere material possessions do not really make us live a fulfilling life. And I think at a macro scale, that translates neatly to a country which is experiencing 8% GDP growth will live a very prosperous life where it will have a lot of the its necessities and sometimes its excesses readily available to it. But, you know, it's called an excess sometimes for a reason. Perhaps there are things beyond money which make us feel a joy and a contentment with life. And these are the questions that we should really think about and have that reflect in the metrics that we measure development. And I think it's definitely unfair for us to just compare countries' developmental status based on how much capacity they can make. It is definitely a valid index to rely on, but it is not the tell-all picture that we really want to compare whether countries are developed. And I think at the end of the day, what makes this very difficult is that it is a normative question, and it is definitely therefore worth more discussion about. But I think the footing stands clear in the sense that if nations were to continue with development solely focusing on GDP, there's certainly a lot of things which it is overlooking, and in the long run might damage how its growth, its purely materialistic growth, will continue. So this definitely serves as a lesson for a lot of the things that we're seeing around Asia, with a lot of discontentment, a lot of sometimes excessive ambition and anxiety with the overly materialistic life. And understand, well, perhaps maybe we have put the cart before the horse, and GDP isn't really all that there is to pursue, and there are other things to make our lives more holistic. This question is particularly valuable to developing countries because it not only changes the way that we see development, but it also changes the way that we do development. And hopefully there will be a point in time where we install policies not only for the sake of material prosperity, but also for the greater well-being of society. And that, I think, is a very important thing. So that was everything that I had to say for this episode. We truly hope that you enjoyed everything that we had. And I want to once again thank the speakers, Dr. Kent Schroeder and Professor Jeremy Brooks, for taking the opportunity to join us today for this very interesting talk. It's been a pleasure being your host, and we hope to see you again next time. Thank you.